Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. This is Democracy Now!
There is a potential for a much stronger escalation, and that is what concerns me. The possibility of transforming Lebanon in another Gaza, which I think would be a devastating tragedy for the world.
Monday's death toll from Israel's massive aerial bombardment of Lebanon has risen to over 550 people, including over 50 children. The deadliest single day in Lebanon in nearly two decades. Tens of thousands of civilians are displaced, now sleeping in schools and makeshift shelters. We'll go to Beirut for the latest. Then, as world leaders gather here in New York to address the UN General Assembly, activists kick off Climate Week with a direct action to shut down Citibank. There were 31 arrests. Citibank, one of the largest funders of fossil fuel expansion.
We are here to shut it down during Climate Week because we know a better future is possible. We do not need to be investing in fossil fuels. The time is now for renewable energy, and we are demanding Citibank hear us.
We'll hear voices from the streets and speak to Kumi Naidu, former head of Greenpeace International and Amnesty International, now president of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty Initiative. And unless the U.S. Supreme Court intervenes today, the state of Missouri is set to kill Marcellus Williams tonight, despite the fact the prosecutor, the jurors, and the murder victim's family all oppose his execution. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati has accused Israel of waging a war of extermination after Israeli airstrikes killed at least 558 people, including 50 children, and injured over 1,800 since Monday. It was Israel's largest attack on Lebanon in nearly two decades. In Israel, Israel said today it will further accelerate its attacks on Lebanon. Israel claimed the airstrike struck 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanon's health ministry said Israel mostly struck civilian sites, including hospitals, medical centers, and ambulances. Thousands of Lebanese residents have fled southern Lebanon, with many heading to Beirut. The UN Human Rights Office warned Israel that sending a warning before attacking civilians is not okay. Hezbollah forces responded to Israel's massive attack by firing missiles at Israeli military bases, arms factories, and other areas. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell warned, quote, "We are almost in a full-fledged war," while UN spokesperson Stéphane Dujarric said the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is alarmed at the large number of civilian casualties reported in Lebanon.
The message to the parties that are firing at each other across the blue line, to all the parties involved in this conflict, is step back from the brink. Stop the escalation. As we just said, there is no military solution at this point that will make anyone in either country any safer.
Israel's attack on Lebanon also killed at least one journalist. Hadi El-Sayed, a reporter for Al-Mayadeen, died after Israel bombed his home in southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Pentagon's announced more U.S. troops would be sent to the Middle East. The UN Human Rights Office is calling on Israel to stop attacking schools in Gaza that provide shelter to displaced Palestinians. Over the past 3 days, Israeli attacks on schools have killed at least 32 Palestinians, including 16 children. The UN agency said, quote, the children of Gaza have already lost schools as a place of education. Now they're being killed in schools as they seek shelter. On Monday, Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Mustafa spoke at the United Nations.
As I speak to you, before you, our people in Gaza are enduring one of the darkest chapters in modern history. For nearly a year now, Israel's genocidal war has caused unprecedented loss and suffering and humanitarian catastrophe. At the same time, our people in the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, continue to face systemic threats driven by escalating settlers' violence, military raids, movement restrictions, and financial siege, withholding of Palestinian tax revenues.
ProPublica has revealed USAID and the State Department's Refugees Bureau both concluded this spring that Israel had deliberately blocked deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza. But U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and other top Biden officials rejected the findings of their own agencies, the two foremost U.S. authorities on humanitarian assistance. Blinken's decision allowed the U.S. to keep sending arms to Israel. Under U.S. law, the government's required to cut off weapon shipments to countries preventing the delivery of U.S.-backed aid. U.S. prosecutors have announced plans to bring attempted assassination charges against Ryan Ruth, the man accused of trying to kill Donald Trump while he was playing golf in Florida. The charge carries a life sentence if convicted. Prosecutors revealed Ruth wrote a letter months ago detailing his plans to kill the former president. The state of Missouri scheduled to execute Marcellus Williams this evening, despite significant indications he was wrongfully convicted. On Monday, Missouri Supreme Court and the governor, Mike Parson, declined to halt the scheduled killing, even though St. Louis's top prosecutor, Wesley Bell, said in a January filing that, quote, new evidence suggests that Mr. Williams is actually innocent, unquote. The prosecutor, the jurors, and the murder victim's family are all against the execution. DNA found on the murder weapon did not match Williams, but instead matched another man. Williams, who's African-American, was convicted in 2001 of killing former St. Louis Post-Dispatch reporter Leisha Gale, who was white, during a robbery. He was convicted by 11 white jurors and one black juror after the prosecution was allowed to preemptively strike out six other prospective black jurors. Last week, Democratic Congressmember Cori Bush spoke about the case on the House floor.
I am urging Governor Parson not to let another innocent man be murdered at the hands of the state. He must heed this call. And as a proud co-sponsor of the Federal Death Penalty Prohibition Act, Congress must also act. Let's end this racist, this flawed and inhumane practice once and for all. Save the life of this innocent man.
Only the U.S. Supreme Court can intervene today to stop Marcellus Williams' execution. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. Climate activists disrupted a speech yesterday by President Biden's climate advisor, Ali Zaidi, during an official Climate Week NYC event. Two protesters held up a banner reading, Off Fossil Fuels, Free Palestine, as they took the stage.
Necessary to have
the Biden and Harris campaign cannot continue to fund and subsidize and approve new fossil fuel projects. They also have to stop funding Israel and the Pentagon, who are continuing to carry out the genocide of the Palestinian people.
And nearby, at Citibank's headquarters in Manhattan, police arrested 31 activists as they blocked the building's entrance and demanded it stop funding fossil fuel projects. Protesters also called for world leaders gathering at the UN General Assembly to put people over profits and end the war on Gaza. Democracy Now! Was there. We'll play voices from that action later in the broadcast. In related news, prominent climate activist Greta Thunberg has joined demands to boycott Chevron over its supplying of energy to Israel.
In Palestine and all over the world, the fight against colonialism and corporations' destruction of the planet are intrinsically linked. Look at Chevron. Everyone knows that Chevron is one of the world's biggest climate criminals. But the oil giant is also fueling Israel's genocide in Palestine.
In California, activists with Sunrise Movement gathered outside Kamala Harris's Los Angeles home demanding the Democratic presidential nominee take serious action on the climate. The protesters brought with them a couch that had been burnt down to its frame in a nearby wildfire. In response, Harris posted on X, she will, quote, tackle the climate crisis with bold action to build a clean energy economy, advance environmental justice, and increase resilience to climate disasters, unquote, but did not lay out any specifics as climate activists have been demanding. In more news from California, the state's attorney general, Rob Bonta, announced California is suing ExxonMobil for lying to the public about plastics being recyclable.
The truth here is that this myth of recycling, this decades-long campaign of deception, has led to and exacerbated the global plastics pollution crisis. And while plastics are not actually being recycled, the one thing that ExxonMobil does recycle is its lies.
President Biden Monday designated the United Arab Emirates a major defense partner as the U.S. seeks to deepen military cooperation in the Middle East, East Africa, and Indian Ocean regions. The White House said in a statement this would facilitate joint training, exercises, and military-to-military collaboration between the U.S. and UAE armed forces. The UAE is only the second nation to receive such designation after India. The announcement came as Biden met with UAE President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan, and despite mounting concerns over the UAE's backing of Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, which has been accused of massive rights abuses, along with the Sudanese military and Sudan's devastating civil war. France has sent a long-banned riot police force to the Caribbean island of Martinique amid mounting protests over the cost of living and inequality. Martinique, which has a majority black population, has been colonized by France since the 17th century. Residents of Martinique pay an estimated 30% to 40% more for food than residents of France. White and French residents of Martinique also hold outsized political and economic power. And in Senegal, authorities have recovered the remains of at least 30 people on a boat off the coast of Dakar. The boat was likely adrift at sea for days. Senegal's become part of a common route for the increasing number of refugees being forced to flee West Africa due to conflict, extreme poverty, and other dire conditions. Most migrants who depart from the region are attempting to reach Spain's Canary Islands as they hope to resettle in Europe. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
The Israeli military says it carried out another airstrike on Beirut today in a southern suburb of the city. This comes as the death toll from Israel's massive aerial bombardment of Lebanon Monday rose to at least 558 people, including over 50 children and over 40 women. More than 1,600 people have been injured. It marked the highest single-day death toll on Lebanon in nearly two decades. Tens of thousands of civilians have been forced from their homes in southern Lebanon in the largest exodus since the 2006 war. Many displaced families are sleeping in makeshift shelters set up in schools in Beirut and other cities. Some 500 people have even crossed into Syria to seek safety, according to Agence France-Presse. Israel claimed the airstrike struck 1,600 Hezbollah targets, but Lebanon's health ministry said Israel also struck hospitals, medical centers, and ambulances. Hezbollah forces responded to Israel's massive attack by firing missiles at Israeli military bases, arms factories, and other areas. Satellite data analyzed by Associated Press showed the wide range of Israeli airstrikes aimed at southern Lebanon, covering an area of over 650 square miles. The aerial bombardment comes as Lebanon is still reeling from last week's attack by Israel, when thousands of electronic communication devices, from walkie-talkies to pagers, exploded at the same time across Lebanon, killing 390 people and wounding nearly 3,000. From where we go to Beirut, where we're joined by Michelle Eid, editor-in-chief of Arawiya, a digital magazine covering the Levant. She joins us from Beirut. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe what's happening on the ground now in Lebanon with this largest single-day death toll in almost 20 years, the massive flight of Lebanese from the south moving towards Beirut? Michelle.
Hi. First of all, thanks for having me. Essentially, what's happening now is a massive exodus from the south. Many people are displaced. They're trying to find a safe haven. And as a result, the roads are jammed. There's an oncoming fuel crisis as well, because people are trying to fill their tanks. And so many people have been stuck on the road for hours on end, trying to reach somewhere safe. And as people were exiting South Lebanon and going on the road towards Beirut, there were airstrikes falling near them, around them. So you can imagine it's a very panic-filled scene. And around Lebanon, so what's happening at the moment is these individuals who are displaced from the south are trying to find safe havens in schools and different shelters all across Lebanon, whether it be the north, Baqa, Mount Lebanon, and people are going, trying to help them, trying to find any basic necessities that they can help them with, provide them with food, with water, with medicine, with sleeping bags so they can sleep. So you can imagine the situation is quite dire at the moment.
And Michelle, these bombing attacks have occurred not just in the south, but also in some northern sections of Lebanon as well. So how are the civilians supposed to know even where to go?
The way that I can describe this is they think about the immediate solution. So once they're bombing the south, people are leaving the south. When they bomb Baqa, they try to find another safe place in Baqa. They don't have the luxury of thinking long term. They don't have the luxury of thinking where would be the safest place for me to be now, especially with the crowding. You can say because there are a lot of people who are trying to find these shelters, who are trying to find apartments. So there's an overflow of demand and maybe not enough supply, or rather, let me fix that. There is supply, but there is also some sort of exploitation of the people who are being displaced from the south. So landlords, for example, there is not a lot of, you can say, give and take when it comes to rent. And so many families find themselves unable to rent an apartment with their children, with their elderly parents, with their members of the family that have special needs or special medical requirements.
And this comes, these attacks come in a situation where Lebanon has already had a long-term economic crisis. Could you talk about the situation in the country as a whole?
You know, prior to the war, the country has already been suffering. It's been suffering since 2019 with the financial collapse. Then after that, with the coronavirus. So public institutions are not able to support the community, the Lebanese population properly, or all communities that live within Lebanon. And so once the war began in October, there was, you know, panic amongst people in the community, in the Lebanese communities, about whether Lebanon would be able to sustain a war, whether the medical sector would be able to sustain the war, whether, you know, directorates that are responsible for food security are able to, whether gas and energy directorates are able to as well. Lebanon is not properly equipped to be able to sustain such a war. And it was not properly equipped to function even ever so normally prior to the war in its normal situation. So as you can imagine, there is panic across not only members of the public, but also people who are in public institutions as well.
Michelle, you're speaking to us from Beirut, so your own family has to be impacted by this. Can you describe both what you've talked about, the chaos Yes. in the streets, what has happened to your family in the south, and what these phone calls mean? The Israel is saying they've sent out tens of thousands of calls. Apparently, Lebanon's Minister of Information got one of these warning calls. The UN Human Rights Office warned Israel sending a warning before attacking civilians is not acceptable.
I can talk about maybe my family first. So I have family living in the south and Bekaa as well. And on a personal level, for the past 2 days, it has been havoc, trying to be able to reach them to make sure that they are okay. My maternal great uncle is stuck in the south because of the situation on the roads. He didn't want to leave the south at first either, because the concept of leaving his home is already painful enough, because this is not the first time the south witnesses such aggression, you know? And so it's been just panic mode on a personal level to be able to try and get my family to safety, especially with data not being able, not being proper as well, not having good connections, so we can't reach them all the time. So as you can imagine, even my family living abroad, they're also in this state of panic, trying to reach their family members here as well. So on an internal level, it's been a mess. And then going on to people receiving texts and phone calls. So dozens, hundreds, maybe thousands of individuals yesterday received either phone calls or texts telling them to evacuate their buildings because they do have some either Hezbollah weapons or Hezbollah personnel in these buildings. And they gave them either a time frame to leave or with no time frame at all. So these individuals, not even knowing, you know, they haven't had time to think of a plan B or a plan C. They had to grab their stuff and just leave their homes, try to find some safe haven, whether near or far. And these people who were conducting these phone calls, for example, the phone calls, they were coming from Lebanese numbers, but the individuals who were doing the calling spoke in formal Arabic, which is very different than our colloquial language, our mostly used language, our informal language. And so, as you can imagine, this induces quite the scary scenario for many people who are also unable to leave right away, who have members of their family who need special support, whether it be a physical disability, a mental disability of the sorts. So it's been quite hard on these families who were across Bekaa, across the south, and even in some suburbs in Beirut.
Michelle Ayed is editor-in-chief of Al Rawaya. She's speaking to us from Beirut. And in our New York studio, we're joined by Lina Munzer, Lebanese writer, translator, senior editor of the arts and literature magazine, The Markaz Review. Her new piece for Middle East Eye is headlined, Israel's War on Lebanon, the trauma of watching the Hollywood movie from afar. Start off with what just has happened in the last 24 hours. Worst single lethal day, deadly day for Lebanon in nearly 20 years, with over 558 people dead, 50 of them children. Your response, looking at all of this from New York.
First, hi, Amy. Thanks for having me here. Honestly, it's very shocking looking at it. The speed with which everything is happening, the death toll, as you said, it's actually at this point, I think it's fully half the amount of casualties that we saw in the 33 days of the 2006 war between Israel and Lebanon, or I should say the assault on Lebanon in 2006. So within one day, we're seeing a huge amount of casualties. And at the same time, we're seeing all of the tactics that they have been using in Gaza. They're kind of speed running what has been happening in Gaza. They've been bombing ambulances, pathways to hospitals. As Michelle was just talking about, they've been asking people to evacuate, but really it is flee. They're, you know, making people panic. And then they're also bombing the roads out, the bridges. People are terrified. It's very difficult for them to find their way out. And it's really, you know, it's, I just left Beirut. I've been there, you know, I live there normally. And I left Beirut a few weeks ago. And knowing that there was a possibility that things would escalate while I was gone, but truly the speed with which this has happened has been incredibly shocking. And, you know, just between one night and the next to wake up and to see full-blown war and this level of casualties and carnage is just, it's just absolutely terrifying. So, you know, my initial reaction really is one of shock, even though I feel we should have been inured watching what's been happening in Gaza over the period of an entire year. We shouldn't be shocked anymore, but still, it is absolutely shocking.
And Lena, I wanted to ask you about the coverage of the media coverage in the United States and Europe on this, because it's clear, number one, that these pager and walkie-talkie attacks were sheer terrorism on the part of Israel, and that this is a naked escalation of the war on Israel's part. Yet that's not the way it's being portrayed. Rather, they're concentrating on the technological sophistication of Israel and being able to use these pagers and these walkie-talkies to attack Hezbollah.
Yes, Juan, absolutely. I mean, basically, what we've been seeing from the beginning of the assault on Gaza as well is the media has been, you know, we use the word complicit, but what does that really mean? I mean, the media has been actively helping manufacture consent for what has been happening, allowing people to not just to be complacent, but to feel that whatever is happening in Gaza, in Lebanon, is well-deserved. You know, this is Israel's counterterrorism. This is Israel defending itself, quote-unquote. And people have bought that to the extent that now Israel can come up with whatever flimsy excuse. You know, one of the things that they've been saying now is that they are bombing locations in the south because Hezbollah uses people's homes to hide rocket launchers. And so any civilian casualties incurred are part of this counterterrorism. And so for me, the pager attack and the way that it was covered is really only just a small part of all of the way that Israel's attacks have been are being covered, you know, whether it's by the fact that they continue to repeat the lies about, you know, burned, raped, mutilated, beheaded babies. If you notice, every single time an Israeli spokesperson speaks, they will never, you know, when they talk about the attacks, they will always, you know, it's like they've been given this directive to use all of these, like, to use this particular language that's very incendiary and to remind people of, you know, burned, beheaded, etc. And no one calls them out on it, even though there is no evidence of any of these things actually, you know, having taken place. And so it was very shocking to me, you know, if this pager attack had happened anywhere else, and we keep saying that, which I think it's actually quite sad that we have to keep saying, imagine this happened to you, or imagine it happened in any other country. What would you think about it in that way? You know, it's this constant feeling of having to remind people that, you know, we are equally as human as anybody else. But truly, I mean, what you had was you had a series of small explosions going off against the intimacy of people's bodies across the entire country. And it was, everybody was in a, it is the absolute definition of terrorism. People were terrified. People were afraid of the electronic devices in their own homes. And yet, you know, you have people covering this as though it were a marvel. I mean, even I saw an opinion piece in the New York Times the other day that began with, even though we're all amazed by this, even though we all think it's such an incredible thing, you know, technological feat that Israel pulled off, we still must admit that this is an act of terrorism. So even if somebody uses those words, it's always couched within within a kind of inherent excuse. And it's frankly sickening.
I mean, yes. It's quite something to, for example, hear Leon Panetta, the former CIA director, the former defense secretary, saying that the blowing up of pagers and walkie-talkies is terrorism. So he's describing it in that way, you know, represents the establishment in the United States. And, of course, you hear Biden and Blinken decrying the fact that there isn't a ceasefire. But at the same time, we bring you this report today from ProPublica, just one of many different reports, that says USAID and the State Department's Refugee Bureau, and this has to do with Gaza, and you make serious links like saying Israel's speedrunning the Gaza playbook. ProPublica's revealed USAID and State Department's Refugee Bureau both concluded this spring that Israel had deliberately blocked deliveries of food and medicine into Gaza, but Secretary of State Blinken and other top Biden officials rejected the findings of the agencies, the two foremost U.S. authorities on humanitarian assistance. That decision allowed the U.S. to keep sending arms to Israel, because under U.S. law, the government's required to cut off weapon shipments to country,